It's July 10th, 1999.
Welcome, everyone, to the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, as we prepare for the much-anticipated final between China and the United States.
More than 90,000 people are gathered to watch the Women's World Cup soccer final, the largest crowd ever to see a women's sporting event.
This is more than a game. This is a defining moment in women's sports history.
It's also about 100 degrees on the field, and the California sun is brutal. The closely fought game is still tied at zero after 120 minutes of soccer. The exhausted American and Chinese players lie on the turf while trainers massage their cramped muscles.
And now, the biggest pressure of their lives, for most of these women, maybe all, their most important penalty kicks ever.
The penalty kick shootout is tied at four, and the USA's final kicker, Brandi Chastain, steps up to the penalty box and into the history books.
Chastain will take it. She missed a penalty kick against China in the Algarve Cup, and they lost that game.
Then the woman known as Hollywood to her teammates whips off her jersey and sets off one of the most memorable celebrations in sports history.
The party begins in Pasadena.
What a day this was, and it continues from the Rose Bowl in Pasadena. The United States has won the Women's World Cup.
Brandi Chastain's kick marked the climax of a summer when millions of Americans and a whole new generation of soccer fans fell in love with their national team. But it marks so much more than just that.
Maybe it's an old cliche to say Rome wasn't built in a day. Put us in the arena, not above the fray. Our sound and fury is on that stage. Let us play, let us play.
I'm Sean Braswell. And this is The Thread, a podcast from Aussie, where we unravel the stories behind some of the most important lives and events in history to discover how one thing leads to another. We launch this season of The Thread as the U.S. women's national soccer team takes the field in France for the 2019 World Cup. This July also marks the 20th anniversary of the 99ers, the 1999 U.S. women's team whose victory at the Rose Bowl on that sweltering summer day remains seared into the memories of millions. In season 5 of The Thread, we tell the incredible backstory behind that World Cup triumph. But it's not a story that happened on its own. This season is about how the weight of history builds behind a single defining moment, how little details can change the course of history. We'll hear about how 19 students at Yale stripped naked in an athletic director's office and changed how female college athletes are treated. How a largely forgotten black transgender lawyer laid the groundwork for multiple civil rights victories. And how a single word placed into a single congressional bill opened up the floodgates of opportunity that led up to that glorious summer day in 1999. The national team's victory in 1999 was not its first Women's Soccer World Cup title. It was not even its first championship in the 1990s. The team started the decade with a World Cup victory in China in 1991. That experience, however, was very different from 99.
You know, no one has names on their jerseys, and only some of the games were televised.
Jen Cooper is a soccer analyst and researcher for Fox Sports and the host of the Mixed Zone podcast. There had never been a Women's World Cup before, and FIFA, the governing body in charge of men's international soccer, wasn't quite sure what to do.
FIFA felt like, well, we don't know if, you know, the women can last 90 minutes, so we're going to make the games 80 minutes long. And of course, they called it not the Women's World Cup. They called it the FIFA World Championship for the M&M's Cup because the tournament was sponsored by M&M's.
Welcome to China and a truly historic occasion. For the first time in the history of American soccer, a U.S. team will play for a world championship.
But the U.S. team did not just come to play. Tim Nash is the author of It's Not the Glory and has covered the women's national team for decades.
No one would believe that the U.S. could play soccer, men or women or dogs or cats. It just wasn't going to happen. So when they went there and they started smashing people, it really turned some heads.
The Americans steamrolled their way through the tournament.
they developed this attacking game. It was just fun to watch. It was entertaining. They just scored an unbelievable amount of goals.
The team outscored their opponents 25-5, winning all six games they played. Michelle Akers, an aggressive midfielder who later helped lead the 99ers to victory, scored 10 of those goals, including 5 in one game, and the winning goal in the final against Norway.
Michelle with a brave run upfield. Here's Akers-Dahl with a chance. Open net. She scores!
The U.S. beat Norway 2-1 before 65,000 people.
First of all, Michelle, what can I say? How does it feel?
I feel great. I mean, I'm going to be floating on seventh heaven until 2 years from now.
Randy, we better get out of here in a hurry. Between all the fireworks and the celebration, there's a whole lot of partying going to go on down here in China.
But back in America, few people cared about the historic victory. Jen Cooper again.
I love the story of Michelle Akers, you know, when they finally get back to New York and, you know, and they're all separate and going home. And the woman on the plane next to her, it's like, oh, where have you been traveling? She's like, I was in China. We won the Women's World Cup. And the woman replies, well, that's nice, dear.
No one knew what a Women's World Cup was.
Caitlin Murray is a journalist and author of The National Team, the inside story of the women who changed soccer.
And when the players got to the airport, pretty much no one was there. You know, the players joke, there were two people there. It was their bus driver and their operations manager.
Unlike 1999, there were no parades or appearances on David Letterman. The national team played only two games the following year. Two. In the 1995 World Cup, the team lost a heartbreaker in the semifinals to their old rivals, Norway. Then, finally, a bigger opportunity came calling. Women's soccer was included in the Olympics for the first time in 1996. Tim Nash.
The 96 Olympics really was the turning point. That was a huge deal. There was still the question of, will anybody come watch?
They did. The women's national team played before packed football-sized stadiums. Jen Cooper again.
It's such a mixed bag, the 96 Olympics, because it had such an incredible impact on the sport, but not many people got to see it unless you were actually in the stadium. The joke at the time was they were calling NBC no bloody coverage because they aired all of about 3 minutes of the final.
NBC barely covered the Olympic gold medal, but there were tens of thousands in the stands cheering. This was the beginning of a movement. And for millions of fans, the movement was synonymous with a single player.
I can be champion of Women's World Cup soccer.
I can be a goalie.
Like Soccer Barbie.
Or a power forward.
Like me.
It's Mia Hamm.
Mia Hamm.
Mia Hamm joined the national team when she was just 15. She was fast, fearless, relentless. One of the greatest goal scorers in the history of international soccer. And by the late 1990s, she was everywhere.
U.S. gold medalist Mia Hamm spends 90 minutes destroying her hair and 90 seconds bringing it back with Pert Plus.
Hamm became a household name. She was in a commercial with Michael Jordan. She was shy, introverted, but gave hours of interviews, signed thousands of autographs. It was a duty she took very seriously.
It's kind of cool. I mean, one of the coolest things is walking into a stadium and seeing those, you know, young girls and young boys wearing your jersey. And it's something that I think is extremely important, and I take responsibility for it.
The amount of pressure on Hamm was enormous, and her teammates marveled at how she handled it all. Tracy Noonan, or Tracy Dukar, as she was known, was a goalkeeper on the 1999 squad.
She was, you know, the face of our team, and she was under a lot of pressure as a forward to produce and to score, and, you know, she managed that unbelievably, in my opinion.
Americans started to pay attention to women's soccer as never before, just in time for the country to play host to its first Women's World Cup in 1999. Marla Messing was the president and CEO of the 1999 FIFA Women's World Cup.
The event had last been played in Sweden, and I think they averaged like maybe 3,000 or maybe even 4,000 people per match. So they weren't thinking of big stadiums or major markets, but after we saw what had happened with the Men's World Cup in 94, as well as the women's soccer event at the 1996 Olympics, we felt like the event had the potential to do well in large stadiums and major markets.
Not everyone was optimistic. Author Caitlin Murray.
You have to keep in mind, at this time, soccer was not a popular sport in the United States by any means. 1 year earlier, in 1998, the men's team went to the World Cup and came in dead last place. It was an absolute embarrassment, and soccer just wasn't cool at the time.
Many doubted a Women's World Cup could fill large stadiums, but World Cup planners did their best to prepare for any outcome.
If tickets didn't sell, they were going to put up tarps and decorations to hide the empty sections. They also blacked out time to have concerts. So if tickets weren't selling well, they would have a concert as part of the event, and then they could maybe sell more tickets that way. In the end, the skeptics were wrong.
And perhaps the biggest reason the skeptics were wrong? An unprecedented grassroots promotion campaign led by the players themselves. Author Tim Nash.
They went to cities where they hadn't been before, parts of the country where they hadn't been before. I mean, they didn't just lock themselves in the hotel and get on the bus and go to training and come back. They were out in the community. They were doing clinics, anything they could to sell a ticket.
The players would stay and sign autographs for hours until every single fan got one. They became ambassadors for the game and for women more broadly. 99er, Tracy Noonan.
We were spending time, you know, after every event, every game, every practice, signing autographs, meet and greets, anytime that we had an opportunity in front of the media to speak and promote, you know, what our message was.
Goaltender Brianna Scurry put it later, we had ownership of that World Cup. It was ours to put on, and it was ours to win. Marla Messing again, former president of the Women's World Cup.
These were amazing women. Some of them had been playing soccer in almost total obscurity for over a decade. They were articulate, intelligent, educated. They cared deeply about the game.
And they were aware they were also role models. This is Lauren Gregg, one of the coaches on the 99 squad.
Every time we stepped out onto a training field or a game, every one of us looked in the eyes of those young kids, boys and girls, and knew that we had such an enormous responsibility to pave a different path for them.
Americans came to know the 99ers and to love them in the weeks and months before the World Cup. They wanted to be part of the team's journey.
I think that's what endeared them so much to the American people, is they became household names. They became people that, not just athletes that they admired, but people that they admired, and that they were real and genuine and open, and they were the role models they never had.
And Women's World Cup tickets started to sell like never before. Soccer analyst Jen Cooper.
4 months before the tournament started, they announced that they had already sold 200,000 tickets, which was about double the attendance of the very small 1995 World Cup. And the response from the press was, "You're lying."
The players themselves didn't quite believe it, and no one knew what to expect when the World Cup finally launched that June. Up next, the team that started in obscurity and became the talk of the nation was about to forever alter the landscape of sports in America. The big day finally came. It was time for the 1999 U.S. women's soccer team to take the field after months of barnstorming the country. The team's opener was at Giants Stadium in New Jersey, an 80,000-seat arena that's usually the site of NFL games and rock concerts. Author Caitlin Murray.
The team was going to arrive at Giants Stadium on their team bus, the way they always do for games. Nothing unusual about that. But as they were approaching the stadium, the traffic started to get really, really bad. And the team was at a standstill, and the players started to actually worry that they were going to be late for their own game.
The players wondered what was causing all of the traffic. Was there something happening in New York City that was backing up to the New Jersey Turnpike?
But then as the ride continues and the players get a little closer, they start to notice that all these cars that are congesting the roads have paint on them that say, "Go USA," and American flags. And they realized all of this traffic is here to see us.
When the players finally got to the stadium, they saw people tailgating and playing pickup soccer games in the parking lot.
The players had spent so much time getting the word out, helping market this event, this World Cup, that I think it was a really gratifying experience for them to see that it had worked.
History will be made today. This is the largest crowd to ever witness a women's soccer match.
It was also the largest crowd to see a sporting event at Giants Stadium. Only the Pope drew a bigger one. The team filled the stadium. Now they had to beat Denmark. Team member Tracy Noonan.
There's a lot of pressure then to do well and to win, because if we do go big and it flops, what's going to really hurt women's soccer?
A scoreless tie came to an end in the 18th minute when number 9, Mia Hamm, received the ball coming down the right side.
Chastain reversing all the way to Mia Hamm. Hamm brings it down, still on it with the left foot, and the goal!
The stadium erupts. Hamm's teammate mob her in a sea of red jerseys.
That was also a really big release for everybody. Like, all right, we've got a goal. Here we go. Everything's going to be okay.
The U.S. won easily, 3-0 over Denmark. Next, they played to a sold-out crowd in Chicago, beating Nigeria 7-1. Then beat North Korea to top their group and advanced to the quarterfinals in Washington, D.C. to play Germany. Journalist Caitlin Murray.
The team started really strong, and they looked really good until they went up against the Germans.
Just 5 minutes into the game, disaster struck right in front of the American goal.
Goal in stoppage time. Chastain back to scoring. She came out, and it's a goal for Germany. On one of those miscommunication plays. Ouch.
It was an own goal, and the U.S. trailed 1-0.
And suddenly, for the first time in the whole tournament, the U.S. was actually at risk of being knocked out.
And Brandi Chastain was at risk of being the GOAT for the American defeat. Coach Lauren Gregg.
Our captain, Carla Overbeck, went to Brandi and said, you know, we need you. And basically, like, snap out of it, we need you. You know, just reframing her immediately.
4 minutes into the second half, Chastain redeemed herself, striking a goal to even the score. President Bill Clinton and First Lady Hillary Clinton celebrated as they watched from a suite above the field. The U.S. defeated Germany and then blew by Brazil in the semifinal. Thousands of people started to turn up to watch team practices. It felt like all eyes were focused on women's soccer that summer, and no longer just on Mia Hamm. Jen Cooper.
One of the smartest things that Mia Hamm did in advance of the tournament was say, hey, I don't want to be in all the ads. So we ended up getting not just Mia Hamm out of the tournament, but Julie Foudy became a household name. Brandi Chastain became a household name. Brianna Scurry became a household name.
And these players did almost everything as a team, something even the television commercials picked up on, including this famous Nike ad.
How'd it go?
He had to drill. I got 2 fillings.
Then I will have 2 fillings.
But Mia, I just examined your teeth. They're perfect.
I will have 2 fillings.
I will have 2 fillings.
I will have 2 fillings.
Commercials aside, the U.S. women's national team was about to play the biggest game of their lives. So much was riding on that final game against China. And there were so many things that could go wrong.
2 days until the finals. And if you don't know what finals, you may already have missed some of the most exciting sports action in a long time.
Yeah, Saturday's championship match between the U.S. and China in Women's World Cup soccer has all the atmosphere of a Super Bowl.
The Women's World Cup final was held in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, the 15th largest stadium in the world. The U.S. team faced a formidable Chinese squad that had cruised through the tournament. Team member Tracy Noonan.
You know, the game was a chess match back and forth. I mean, it was opportunities, great saves, back and forth, back and forth.
Tackle at the edge of the box and clear. What a gallant effort from Chester.
The game was a scoreless tie after 90 minutes. The American defense, led by Michelle Akers, held China to just 2 shots on goal. Then, 10 minutes into extra time, China launched a corner kick and sent a header toward the far post. U.S. goaltender Brianna Scurry, guarding the near post, could not get to it.
Off the corner from China. Header, send up the line. Rebound was clear. The ball was heading for goal.
Defender Christine Lilly lunged upward and headed the ball away, preventing an almost certain Chinese goal. The game was still scoreless after 120 minutes.
Referee has just looked at the watch. That's it. The winner of the 1999 Women's World Cup will be decided on penalty kicks.
In a penalty shootout, each team takes turns shooting at the goal and the opposing team's goalkeeper. The team with the most goals after five attempts wins. Author Caitlin Murray.
The penalty shootout is just designed to play tricks on people's minds. And there are all these little psychological things that players do. Either they look at the goalkeeper so the goalkeeper knows they're not scared, or they block the goalkeeper out. They walk up, they only focus on the ball, they don't pay attention to anything else.
It was a situation the U.S. players were well prepared for. Coach Lauren Gregg.
You never know what moment is going to change a game. The penalty kicks themselves, we prepared for that. I had countless, you know, pages and pages of documented penalty kicks all spring. So we were way more prepared for that moment, as prepared as you can ever be to have to win a World Cup, you know, on penalty kicks.
But the pressure was still enormous. Caitlin Murray.
I think the players felt the weight of the moment, and they couldn't let anything going wrong throw them off their mission, which was to cap off this fairy tale, this moment that they had helped create. They had to win.
The first two American kickers, veterans Carla Overbeck and Joy Fawcett, nailed their kicks past the Chinese goalkeeper. But China matched the U.S. shot for shot, and it was 2-2 in the shootout. So the pressure mounted on the goalkeepers to make a save. Jen Cooper.
Any goalkeeper knows when you're going into a penalty kick situation, you're lucky if you get one. But if you get one, you've really given your team the opportunity to win.
As the third Chinese kicker came forward, U.S. goalkeeper Brianna Scurry stared her down.
The shot! Save Scurry!
Scurry dove left and batted the kick away. Suddenly, the Americans had a chance to take the lead. It all came down to Brandi Chastain, the last kicker in the USA's rotation.
On this next kick, Chastain will take it. She missed a penalty kick against China in the Algarve Cup, and they lost that game.
Chastain placed the ball on the spot and took a few steps back. Tracy Noonan.
Yeah, I mean, we were all standing on, like, the very edge of the sideline, holding hands, like, anything that we can do. Like, we kind of don't want to look, but we want to look. Like, it's so nerve-wracking.
Chastain fired a shot across her body to the right side of the goal with her left foot.
Go!
Every time I watch that video, it always looks like it's going to go out. It's a pretty dramatic, risky shot to take.
The stadium erupted, and Chastain's teammates rushed toward her.
And then the moment that she scored it, it was just like, absolute. And I think everyone just like ran to Brandy, of course.
Chastain released some of her emotion by ripping off her jersey and waving it around her head. Then she dropped to her knees in her sports bra with both fists in the air. Caitlin Murray.
There was that iconic photo of her holding her jersey in her sports bra, celebrating just this release of just pure joy. That is a moment that I think still to this day is one of the most iconic moments in all of sports.
The victory meant so much to women's sports, but it meant something to more than just women. Two-thirds of the TV viewers who watched that World Cup were men.
There wasn't a gender tag on the game.
Stacey Enos played on the very first women's national team almost 35 years ago.
It was just like, that was one of the best sporting events ever. And people didn't distinguish male or female, but they were genuinely walking up to me on the street saying, I have never been so captivated by soccer in my whole life. That was the best sporting event ever.
The players paraded down Disneyland's Main Street in California. They appeared on late night talk shows. They journeyed to the White House to meet the president and first lady.
They've definitely stolen our hearts. And by creating the largest women's sporting event in history, they have exploded the myth once and for all that women's sports can't attract fans and public attention. And it is about time that that has happened.
It was about time. In fact, it was long overdue. And the 99ers' journey would not be possible without another group of talented and undaunted women, the first U.S. women's national team in 1985. We tell their story on the next episode of The Thread.
The U.S. looked like they were playing in their first ever games, and that's how the results went.
And there were few upsides to even being on the team.
The players on the early national teams were not doing it to be famous or get rich or be on TV, because those things weren't even possibilities yet.
But they had something more valuable. They had a deep love of the game, and they were willing to sacrifice everything for it.
It was choosing between doing something you loved, playing soccer, or building a career and actually making a living and having money. That was the choice that the players had to make.
To be the change you want to see, add your thread to the tapestry. You can be the truth that'll set us free. Hear the congregation say, let us play, let us play.
The Thread is produced by Robert Koulos, Shannon Williamson, and me, Sean Braswell. Evan Roberts engineered our show. This episode features the song Let Us Play, written and performed by Teacup Gin. You can hear more of their songs at teacupgin.com. To learn more about The Thread, visit aussie.com/thethread, all one word. And make sure to subscribe to The Thread on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on iHeartRadio or listen wherever you get your podcasts. Check us out at aussie.com or on Twitter and Facebook.